Welcome back, everyone. I'm Sam, and this is Makerspace, a podcast run by Christian Education National. This is our 10th and final episode of the season and year, and so I wanted to say a thank you for listening, subscribing, and sending me messages about what you enjoyed. We've had some great conversations, and we'll pick up again early next year with another fantastic group of experts. In the meantime, any sharing or rating is really appreciated. For this final episode, I got to have a special conversation with a friend and colleague of mine, Julia Vidal. Julia is a senior lecturer at the National Institute for Christian Education and has extensive experience in research and policy development. In this episode, however, we're actually here to discuss her new book of poetry, writings collected from her journal following her husband's sudden death 3 years ago. Her book, Valley of the Shadow, is well worth picking up as an exploration of death, faith, grief, and hope. A link to her website is in the episode notes. Here is my chat with Julia. Okay, welcome everybody, and welcome Dr. Julia Vidal. It's very nice to sit with you. We're colleagues who have had a little bit to do with each other through the National Institute of Christian Education. But we haven't really had heaps of time to talk about more personal things. But you released a book earlier this year. You released it at the iTech conference. And it was a very special book. And you not only released the book, you spoke on it in a series of little, I guess, sermonettes or devotionals that you did each morning. And I think it'd be fair to say, while it was probably a very intense experience for you to do that, and you'd be exerting a lot of yourself to do that, it meant a lot to other people. And I think you managed to sell a lot of books. So, I mean, that alone is a metric of a lot of people connected with this. And because of, I've read the book myself, and it's very special, and a lot of you in there. But I guess before we get into that, I wondered if you would just be able to give yourself a short introduction so people know who you are, and then we'll get into this book that you wrote and published this year.
Thanks, Sam. Good to be here. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Been looking forward to this chat. So I'm Julia. I work for the National Institute of Christian Education. And that's obviously affiliated with CEN, who Sam works for as well. I've been working for the National Institute about three and a half years. So it's kind of been a little bit more of a recent thing, although I feel very much part of the woodwork there now, which is great. I've really enjoyed working there. My role at the National Institute is a senior lecturer. I help with some of the sort of core courses, but my main role is with research and research students who are master's degree students who are doing their the research component of their master's degrees. I also help with faculty research as well. So all things research, love research. Prior to working at the National Institute, I worked for the University of Tasmania for many years, probably about 10 years in research only, doing research. So sociology is my background, so teaching in sociology, but also researching in a couple of their institutes as well, particularly around housing affordability and homelessness, doing a lot of policy development work at a national and state and also local sort of government scale. So a lot of research in my background, because an academic work. I'm from Hobart. I live in Hobart, Litruana, and my family here. I have three girls. Was married to Michael. We'll talk a little bit more about that, I guess. But I've lived here for probably about 25 or 6 years now, and Tasmania is actually my home historically, so have lived out of the state for a little while in little pieces here and there, but mostly here in Hobart for the last 25 plus years. So
blue Australian and Tasmanian.
True blue, absolutely. I'm glad that you linked Tasmania with Australia very nicely there, Sam. You've learnt well.
I know. Well, it's only because I think Tasmania and New Zealand share a common experience of being left off maps and not feeling a part of things. So I
Exactly.
understand.
The poor cousin. Yep, that's it.
Well, cool to hear a bit about you. And professionally, obviously, really great that you're on the team. But it's what we're talking about today is not necessarily heavily into the professional space. It's definitely more of a personal thing. Your book that you released emerged out of a very difficult time for you. And I've read that, and I found it very moving myself. I wonder if you were just able to basically tell the story of what happened and how this book came to be.
Yeah, sure. I'll try and keep a short version. yes, I have been married to Michael for well, it would have been 30 years this year. So we married in 1994, a long time ago, and travelled together. We lived in Melbourne for a number of years. Michael was an architect, and while I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, we went overseas and spent some time working in St. Petersburg and London, and came back. And when we came back from that, we came and moved back to Melbourne. Sorry, moved back to Hobart, and Hobart's been our home ever since. And we were married for quite a while before we had kids, about 11 years. So but then we had three daughters, so Aja, Mimi, and Lexi. They are now 19, 16, and 14. And we made Hobart our home, and we've been really involved in church community over that time. We've been involved in missional church community. It's been our kind of focus. Michael and I were for quite a while leaders of a missional community here in South Hobart. And about 3 years ago, Michael came home from work one day, and it was a Tuesday night, and he actually came home. Tuesday night was his dinner night. He made dinners on Tuesday night, so he made some butter chicken. And I came home from work pretty late. I think it was about probably was 6:30 or 7 o'clock, and we sat down and had dinner together. My eldest daughter was out having dinner somewhere else, so there was just the four of us, and it was just a pretty normal Tuesday night kind of evening affair. And after dinner, Mick went out to pick up Aja from up the road and got home. When he got home, I was still hanging around upstairs just chatting with the girls, and we had a new puppy, so he was, I remember that night we were dressing him up in one of the girls' undies, and he just looked ridiculous. But Mick made a cup of tea, put the kettle on, and went downstairs, and he was going to do some work downstairs. So anyway, about half an hour later, I just noticed that the cups were still on the bench, and I thought, oh, I wonder Mick didn't come back for the cups of tea. So I made the cups of tea, and I went downstairs and went into my office, and I could see that he'd been in the office, but he wasn't there. So I poked my head around the corner and just said, Mick, where are you? And I could see that the light was on out in the outside underneath the patio where the wash was, and I thought I was doing the wash because he did the wash. Good, isn't it? He did the cooking and did the wash. I'm pretty lucky. And anyway, so I thought I was doing the wash. That's fine. So I went back in and sat down, and then the girls were looking for him, and I said, oh, he's out doing the wash. So my youngest daughter went out to look, but on the way she actually tripped over him and came. Actually, she didn't come running into me. She went upstairs and, yelled out to her sisters. I'm not sure why she did that, but anyway, they came back down, and then I went out and found Mick, and he was in the dark, and he had collapsed. So then began, a very pretty frantic kind of time of getting. So I got, one of the girls ran and got our neighbours. I rang 000 straight away and had the ambulance on the phone, and had the ambos on the phone. They took 9 minutes to get to us. In that time, our neighbours were doing CPR, but I already knew he was gone. He had already died. And then the ambos worked on him for 30 minutes until they called it. So, that was all a pretty traumatic time for all of us. And then began a very different kind of life for us. That was just over 3 years ago now. It's been huge. It's been huge for the girls were 11 and 13 and 16 at the time. It's been a really challenging 3 years.
Yeah, and no amount of good that comes out of it really makes up for any of the loss. And as I read through your book, I was struck with that, and of how much of a gift it is for someone to work in their grief to produce something out of it. And I think anyone that's experienced any form of grief would understand that. And I think there's a few real gems in what you've written. And I was just wondering if I could pull some of that up and just read a little bit. That really stuck with me. I mean, yeah, it doesn't really get more major than that experience. But you say in near the beginning of the book, you say, I've heard of the shadow of valleys with no hills, muted greys, and where the only sound is the rushing of one's own blood, where signposts point backward. The road ahead is a thicket obscured, the mire at one's feet, quicksand. Yes, I'd heard of the shadow, theory no more, and now here I stand in this strange new land that stretches up before. And I mean, what you feel and read in this book is this moving away of from grief being kind of this abstract concept, which we can quite easily theologize, I think, and you being willing to not go to that place too quickly and to actually articulate that. So I wondered if you could speak a little about that, about, what are the some of the, for lack of a better word, the treasures that grief can give us. It doesn't make up for it, but of actually not trying to find the answers, but actually just sitting with it.
Thanks. Good question. Oh, look, there's so many elements to that. Hard to know where to start, really. I think gifts. There are a lot of gifts in it, but they're hard won, and that they're ones that come unbidden and uncalled for and unwanted in many ways. I think, one way to look at this is that I think I've had to, well, firstly, yes, the experience of it has completely changed my understanding of grief and suffering and what, and actually who God is. I think that's a really big thing. I would say, suffering brings with it, suffering or grief brings with it all sorts of paradox, and I think I've learned to see a little bit more in that way. That the deepest, for me, the deepest loss has also brought about these places of real joy and depth and feelings that I have never really felt before. Anger has come to sit a lot alongside compassion and empathy. I think I've really grown in compassion and empathy for people, particularly people who have broken, because I've just had to sit in that place of being broken, just stripped and broken, so many times now in different ways than I had ever experienced before. So, I just had to grapple with the stripping back and the loss of so much stuff, financial freedoms, loss of time, loss of companionship, loss of another parent, all the different layers that happen. It's not just one thing, it's not just loss of a person, there's just all these continual layers that go on and on. And I think that's really given me a different kind of compassion and empathy for others. I also see a really different side of God. And I think I would say, and I don't really like to say this, but grief, being in a state of grief and suffering has, I don't know, I think it's shown me and I can see myself a lot more clearly. And I think that's
Mm-hmm.
because you go through all this stripping and you're sort of brought face to face with who you really are, you know, and you realize that all those layers that you sort of overlay on your life, self-reliance, control, your job, who you put your faith in, where you put your security in, you realize that actually a lot of that's not God. And I think if you're willing to sit in that painful place and to allow God to sit in it with you, you see sides of God that you just haven't seen before. And that is a gift, because if you take reality to be being in the presence of God, and that's the point and purpose of life, then actually that's a really beautiful gift.
Which really echoes, Jesus's words that, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. And there's a certain, you talk about being stripped back, and there's a certain level where you've just got nothing at that point. And at that point, you're ready to experience what God can give you only when you admit there's no one else or nothing else that can do that for you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so often it's kind of being reduced to nothing and sort of sitting in your own bereftness that you realize. And I can imagine that would be an incredibly difficult, soul-destroying place if you didn't have hope in God. But for me, it's really drawn me into, questioning where does my hope come from and where does my hope lie? And I've been able to see, I've just needed God. I've just really needed God, because I've been weak and broken and haven't had the capacity in myself so much. And it's not just about seeing God. Well, it is about seeing God, but different sides of God. So one of the things that I really felt when, and there's another thing about seasons here, so that I kind of bring these two together, but there's been seasons in my life of how God has revealed himself to me. And before Mick died, I feel like I was in a really flourishing phase. Like I was learning lots about God. I was doing a lot of stripping back of myself and dying to myself anyway. But there was some really beautiful fruit coming from that in my church and in my work. And when Mick died, it's like the engine had been kind of going full throttle in my life. And then Mick died, and then the engine just stopped. And it was like my life just slowed right down. Everything just stopped and went quiet, and God went quiet too, which was a challenge. But I'd also read enough to know that that was something that other people had experienced, and I didn't ever really feel abandoned by God. I knew that God speaks to us in different ways in different seasons. And in this season, one of the gifts that was given to me was that God spoke really, really loudly through my community. I saw God's hands and feet in a really different way than I had experienced before, where I was really, really looked after and embraced and just held really closely by my church community, my friendship community, my family community. And in this time, I saw God working in different ways that I would never have the capacity to see if I wasn't looking for that, or if I wasn't in a place to need that. So. I also saw myself, like everything went just really quiet and God was quiet, and it was just a place for many, many months and even a couple of years where I just felt like I didn't really have to say anything or do anything or be anything. It was just, I felt like, and I spoke about this at ITEC, just like I was a seed and that I was buried, but buried to grow. And because that's what a seed does, if it's buried, it lies fallow, and it waits. It waits until the right time to start to spring and grow. And that time was a real season of just lying fallow and waiting on God, and not even necessarily hearing God in the ways I was used to, and just learning to listen to God in a really different way. But I've never felt a period of time in my life where I felt that I was as embraced and loved and just completely surrounded by God. So that was a really beautiful experience.
I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because I mean, the New Testament seems pretty clear on all of this. Like, Paul writes, I want to be made like him in his death, not in his
Yeah.
resurrection. Like, what are you talking about? You're like, Jesus was weak and dependent and experience of emptiness, the void,
Yes. Yeah.
coming into the valley of the shadow of death. And
Yeah.
there seems to be this big link to suffering and the suffering God, and not shying away from that because there's
Yeah.
something real that happens in the crucible of that,
Yeah.
which is interesting because a lot of modern Christianity seems to want to avoid so much of that and sound like motivational speakers. And I guess, when you hear someone like yourself speaking, you're like, man, you've gone through the crucible and there are things that you find there that you only find there, and it doesn't make it worth it at all, but it certainly it's real, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jesus says, if you want to follow me, you're not in control. Like, I'm the one in the driver's seat, not you. And you've got to, embrace suffering. Don't run away from it. And I do think, even in the Western Christian church, we are pretty used to pursuing happiness and pursuing a good life, in ways that actually really obscure the, and I say this carefully, but obscure the beauty and the knowledge of God that comes from sitting in a place of being stripped back. And in my case, I haven't chosen that, but and I don't, it's not something that I would say I would want to experience again, or I don't wish that I experienced it because of that, but I'm a different person because of it. And I, the knowing God more is something I want in my life, and I'm really thankful for that. Yeah, and there's a strange curiosity and paradox and mystery in all that that we can't explain, except that when we look at Jesus, we know that he suffered in order to bring life to us, and that we're asked to do the same thing.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a strange glory, I think would be Bonhoeffer's words,
Yeah.
which reminds me of a chunk in your book that I just want to read on this, which you're talking about a God that suffers. And I just read that. I think this is beautifully put. And it reminds me of C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed and also Nicholas Waldorf's Lament for a Son. So the same sort of reaching and finding God in amongst the worst things. And the way you say it is, and it isn't just us who weigh our anger, sit with the rage, burn with the heat, and lash our tongues with curses towards injustice, and draw lines in the sand to annihilate all who dare cross over. Lines that blow away with the wind. You too entered that fray. And to articulate the brutality of an experience like that alongside a God that won't remain apart from it, is a deeply theological thing, but also this incredibly existential one as well, where this is a God that gets his hands dirty.
Yeah, totally. I wrote that poem because it just occurred to me that, it's the poem's called Imago Dei, and it's all about us being like made in the image of God. And I wrote it because but through my suffering, it occurred to me that actually God's emotions are all over the Old Testament and the New Testament. But I just hadn't seen them as God's emotions before. I'd kind of shrunk away from them because I'd seen that as anger and jealousy, and I kind of didn't see God as a God of emotional expression. And it's like actually, God feels deeply, and I got that when I started to feel the depth of my own feelings. And that when you love something and you love someone, if we love, we will experience grief. And I then looked at the Old Testament expressions of God's anger and his lament as expressions of love. And actually, his expressions of grieving deeply for the loss of the love of his people, and grieving deeply for the meaninglessness of that loss, and for grieving for being alone, and being walked away from the people that he loved and loves. And I just felt like I could feel God and understand his emotions in the same way, and understand my own emotions as well because of that, I guess. Yeah.
Which again, to bring up Waltersdorf, he has that amazing line, every lament is a love song, and will one day all love, all laments just be about love? And which echoes that sentiment, isn't it? You know, grief, love with nowhere to go, and that's actually worth holding on to and letting it become you at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're people that are made to love, and the deepest desires of our heart are that we love. You know, it's interesting. I've read Walter Storch's Living with Grief, which is I think it's only been written this year, actually. So it's his kind of more cognitive reflection on his time of grief. His Lament for a Son was just an outpouring of grief, and this one is a bit more of a sort of theological reflection on that time. And he was kind of asked to write that, you know, for many years along the way, and he didn't want to. But actually, his work with the prisoners at up at near Calvin University really prompted him to do that. So it just reminds me, I guess, that you know, there are different ways to think about grief and suffering, and that I don't, well, I don't know, like, you know, the sort of Calvin's way of thinking about grief, of suffering, which is like God causes it, and therefore we can be, it's a gift that I should then thank God for, and that it's meant to help me turn into someone that becomes better morally and spiritually. That's a bit of a soul making, I suppose he calls it, theology of suffering, or a bit more of a an Augustine kind of view that, you know, got to look at the big picture. All this stuff happens in it, but God's in control of the big picture, and we need to sort of keep our minds and hearts oriented towards the big picture of flourishing in life, and not sort of get caught up in too much in loving the things around us. And that comes back to the point of loving. And I just don't think that that's what who God is. You know, God, like our being, our imago Dei, our image of God is that we love deeply, and we do that because God loves us deeply. And you know, suffering, I think, doesn't come from a world where stuff just happens and we need to learn to get over it. I think suffering happens because we live in a world where there's evil and it's gone awry. And actually, God says no to that, and that's, you know, Walter Storch idea. And I think he draws that from Karl Barth, that, you know, that actually suffering is God's world gone awry, and God says no to that, and he actually takes up our cause in that. He enters into this world, becomes one of us, and suffers all that we suffer, and that we do that, and that he does that with us. You know, he becomes acquainted with our grief to the greatest extent in and through Jesus. And so, you know, we have a God who suffers deeply and is afflicted deeply like us, and shares our grief and suffering. But the other side of that, which I really caught my attention when I read this, was it's not just that God suffers with us, but when we suffer as human beings, we can then understand the dimension, another deeper dimension of the life of God as well. You know, we become bonded to God in suffering. And I think that's what I kind of mean when I say I feel like I feel like there's a connection and an intimacy with God that I couldn't grasp before, because I know that God is with me. I know that God has suffered what I suffer, and I know that I'm not alone in that. Yeah, and the struggles and the grief that we go through in our life, God also, it finds a home in God.
Yeah, which echoes, I mean, I'm gonna keep doing this, but this other chunk that you have nearer to the end, where you start to reflect, and it starts to sound more like a prayer, I guess. And you've got this section that says, "You are my continuity. You are my continuity in the great and sudden, in the great and sudden dismembering and dismembering and discontinuity, discontinuity of death. You are there. You are there. Still, still." And you can just feel in this that I mean, this is a hard one thing where. Really, I mean, what death, what suffering, what endings do is they just remind us that of all the things we make of our lives, underneath it all, our being itself is held by God, and it's learning to sink into that and not cling to these other things to give us that being held in the universe. And suffering forces us there. doesn't it? So, I mean, yeah, I love the way you've articulated that.
Yeah, thank you. It's and I, you know, that poem again, it came out of just the deep knowledge that I had that God was with me. And you know, it's something right from the beginning I felt like I could say, I trust you, God. And I, you know, trust is something you have to work on. There's been plenty of times where I've just gone, what, you know, like I, what's going on? I feel completely out of control, God, and I don't know what I'm doing or where I am or how to do this. But God has always been there, and I think what I've learned to do is just to talk to God about that, to actually just be really raw and open with God, and allow, you know, my knowledge that God understands me and understands my suffering and our suffering. To inform the way that I communicate with God, and you know, compared to the way I used to pray, now it's all just very like, yeah, it's just much more real and raw, and I love that actually. I think it's beautiful to talk to God. You know, God is close and He's a friend and wants to be the most amazing father that He can.
I love the way that you talk about hope in this book, and because of the way you framed it and how honest you get, it's not a cheap hope. It's a deep hope. And there's one section in particular that I really saw that in. You say, there will be a day in 1,000 years when my fingers are unfurled, my palm open, skin tender, vulnerable, when I hold naked to the stars all I have, which is nothing, and am held in everything that is, when again I am called by the soft words in which the universe is covered, my beloved, my beloved. And you've got the sense of what you've experienced is a little taster of what will be in all and through all, which is this declaration that all things will be made well. The everything would be made to feel like it's a bad dream, which is an incredible hope that, you know, God ultimately says no to this and that death is the enemy. But yeah, I like the way that you don't just run to the right answer. You say, actually, you know, this is a marathon in some ways.
Yeah, thanks. I think that poem is very much about you know, one day, because so often in my life I feel you know, continually quite small and broken, and like I'm not doing a good job of parenting alone, and you know, having three teenage girls can be pretty tricky at the best of times, let alone when they're kind of navigate their own worlds of grief and losing a dad, and you know what that means for their identity and so forth. And I have felt very often very like, oh, this is just, it's just hard, it's just hard yakka. And that yeah, I think that poem sort of came out of just a desire that, you know, that I can live with that openness to God, for God's resurrection hope, which is a future thing, but it's also a now thing, to be with me in the now, knowing that one day my palms will be all the way unfurled, and that I will know, and I will know fully that, you know, the words of God calling me beloved. When I know them now, I know I'll know them one day. But yeah, that actually we get to live in the light of that now, and that's what that hope is. And I really like the way N.T. Wright, N.T. Wright talks about this, is about in his, I think it's Surprised by Hope, he talks about the new creation, that actually we kind of live in this overlap between heaven and earth. Well, when Jesus' death and resurrection actually broke through the future resurrection and hope and victory of Jesus, to bring about a new heaven, and actually cracked that through into our current life here, and that we kind of live in that beam of light from heaven. So the hope that we have in the one day, actually we can, it comes forward into now, and we can actually live and be in the presence of God right here and right now, even in the brokenness, even in the pain, even in the grief, even in all the places where we feel broken and actually are broken, because that doesn't just get fixed. We are living in the now and the not yet. But yeah, to live in the light of that, to see the beauty of the hope of what God wants to restore and is doing that through us now, you know, we get to co-create, we get to be part of generating that and bringing that about, bringing God's vision of bringing heaven to earth here now. It's not just a future scoop in that sense.
You've got to sort of fight for that tooth and nail sometimes. Like I,
totally.
At times where I've really processed death, I ended up praying prayers like, you better have done what you said you've done about death. Like this resurrection stuff might be it, because if it isn't, we've got nothing. And you end up just contending for the stuff and realizing that really this is the only hope. Like that, you forget it. Like this Christianity is not a self-help, make you feel better, therapeutic thing going on. It's all about the resurrection, and that's really it. And yeah, you fight for that. You really do.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know, you know, I have an image of God being held, God holding Mick, and Mick being somewhere where I will see him again one day. And look, I don't know what it'll actually be like. I don't know what, I know that we get to be with God. I know that Mick is with God. But there's an amazing amount of hope holding, like even as someone who's lost someone, knowing that there's continuity with that person in some way across time and place is an enormous, it's an enormous hope. It's an enormous, it's actually really psychologically and emotionally, it's actually a really helpful way of dealing with grief as well. You know, to retain that connection with your person, the person that you've lost is really important. Yeah, there's so many things in that, but yeah. Contending is a good word, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of thinking when it comes to a teacher in a Christian school, and they're sort of listening to this and they're like, actually, yeah, we need to do this well. And the way we talk about this stuff with students is pretty important. What are some things that you would like to see or hear in classrooms, or even just in school practice, to allow students to think about this in helpful ways that really set them up to do this well?
Yeah, great question. I've thought about this a little bit, not so much from the perspective of being a teacher or seeing teachers in the classroom, because I don't have that experience. So you'll have to take this with a bit of a broad brush sweeping statement, and probably more from the perspective of a parent actually, who's you know, got three daughters in a couple of different schools, and daughters who have had to navigate grief in really different ways, and just as a observer of what's going on in schools, and from that perspective, I do, you know, my reflections on that is that, you know, in schools, and I guess my experience has been in Christian education, because my two youngest daughters are in two different Christian schools, that schools don't actually, or in classrooms in particular, there's not a lot of attention that's given to that place of grief and sadness or pain in the school context. Now, caveat to that is that I think in both the cases of where my girls go to school, that the social support mechanisms in place have just been fantastic. Like, my girls have been really beautifully supported by, you know, key staff, you know, in that kind of social support way. I think that's been excellent. But there's something about educators, all educators in every class, being uniquely positioned to be open and vulnerable themselves in appropriate ways about their own grief, and just as a learning place for students to understand, or even for teachers to be a mirror about how to respond in grief, or how to give space to grief and suffering in the world. And I'm not just talking about grief of someone, for a child who's lost a parent. I'm talking about all sorts of grief. There's the grief of losing a parent. There's a grief of losing someone in your family, a grandmother, you know. There's the grief of having deep anxiety. which a lot of students are experiencing now. There's grief when it comes to looking at the news and seeing what's happening in Israel and Palestine. There's a grief that comes with that. And, you know, I wonder, as educators, how we create space for students to process that kind of grief together and to learn that, I guess that you can sit alongside with each other as you suffer. I think educators can model what that looks like in having some vulnerability to their own students. And of course, that needs to be appropriate and needs to be time and place is important. But there are spaces in that for educators to do that. And, you know, rather than just when students are expressing grief or, you know, have experiencing grief, that you sort of put them outside the classroom and send them to the social supports or the chaplain or however, as important as that is. And there's an example that I love. It's not an example of grief or sadness. It's an example of holding space for the things that matter and really affect our learning. So I guess with my daughters, I've just noticed that they've done this grief really, really differently. And my younger daughter in particular really struggles in the classroom. She struggles with a whole bunch of things, and it's related to, you know, the trauma of that night. It's related to just because they're still developing, they don't have the resources, they don't have what they need yet to sometimes to process and understand what they're feeling. So actually, as they begin to grow, that stuff that they grow into that stuff, and they realize things are fresh over and over again, all the way up until they're in their mid-20s when their brains have fully formed. So there's a whole, you know, the whole road of kind of work that you can do with students. One example that I really like, and if you're interested in reading this article, it's by David Smith and Joyce, and I'm sorry I don't know her last name, but it's a joint article. It's going to be in our next CTJ issue, which comes out in November. But David and Joyce write this article together. David starts and he talks about the fact that he was asking a new class, an intensive class at Calvin University, to write about how their upbringing might influence the way that they learn in the classroom. So this his one of his students, Joyce, writes about her assignment. She wrote about her homeland, which was Nigeria, and about the English colonization of Nigeria, of our homeland, and that she associated the British with colonial violence, and that actually having David stand up as with a British accent actually really affected her ability to learn. She couldn't get past that sort of sense that his background, it was just a real barrier for her. She couldn't get past that. So she wrote about this in her assignment. And David talks about the fact that he took this assignment and grappled with it over the weekend because he didn't really have anything to do with Nigeria, didn't know much about it, and had to grapple with all his own feelings and emotions about how to approach this, knowing that he was a barrier to her learning just by virtue of the fact of his own heritage. So to cut a long story short, what he decides to do is to allow her, invited her to speak at the next class and to open the class by just talking about that experience, because his learning objective was to understand how students' cultural background shape their ability to learn in the class. And he wanted to give her space to actually give an example, a really good example of how that happened. So she opened the class. He knew that she might do that because she was a bit of a leader anyway. So she was happy to do that. He sat right at the back of the class in the back corner, sat down and sort of got right out of the picture and let her tell her story. And for both of them, it was a really transformative experience. And they've written now an article about that together. And I think, you know, just to shift that back into the space of pain and grief and loss for students, how as an educator can you make a space to allow students to talk about the pain and grief that they feel in their life? And there's a whole range of different ways that or different kind of griefs that students carry with them, and often really silently, and feeling like they have no voice to voice that, or to actually share that, or share in other students' pain. You know, how can you create space in your classrooms to share moments of grief together and give them space to do that collectively, and also to walk and sit alongside each other in that pain and grief. So, yeah.
Wow, those are really, really good suggestions. As we come to the end, I actually just wanted to draw attention to a line that just kind of took me by surprise. I think I was sitting there reading this book and, I was on the brink, but I wasn't quite cracking. And then finally, this line got me, and yeah, then I cried. And it was this line, which isn't about grief. It's actually about delight and love. And you write this to Mick. You write, "I imagine you gazing out to the river, then back at me, your trademark delight in both." And there's just, oh, even now, just something in the way that you wrote that, which is the goodness of life itself and the irreplaceability when it's gone. And you just captured that in a way which I think anyone can remember, someone who delighted in them that's no longer around, and you just, and letting that actually make you tender.
Thanks. I'm going to just put the spotlight back on Mick for that one because, you know, he just was someone that, in a way that I just never, it was just never really in me to begin. Not in me. It wasn't my default. For him, he had just this default of noticing delightful things, noticing beauty. I mean, he was very aesthetically driven. He loved all things beautiful, and his work was about creating beauty. He was an architect and loved the built form, but also very much about how humans occupy and live in built spaces, in terms of, you know, in making those spaces quality and about living well. And yeah, I just learnt so much from him in that. He always just drew back to what was beautiful in life and what was delightful, and he slowed down enough to notice all that. And I mean, part of the grief I feel is that he's not, you know, I, that I mean, I don't feel like I've stopped learning from him. I guess that's one thing. I haven't stopped learning from him. I notice beauty now, I much more than I used to. And I think this is, I did, you know, I think he just, this is where Mick was made in the dimension of God, like just to see and notice beauty and to bring that in so many different ways, in music, in you know, visual forms, in texture. Like, he was just across all kind of senses. He was just so engaged in creating beauty. So yeah, you know, that poem just comes out of just seeing him see delight. Which is just a beautiful memory.
Sounds like a special guy.
He was.
Well worth missing and well worth writing a book about. And Well, if people are listening to what you've been talking about and would like to grab a copy of your book, it's In the Valley of the Shadow, is that right?
It's called In the Valley of the Shadow. It's a little blue book like this. You can get a copy on, I've got a website now, it's juliavidao.com. That is a bit of a landing page where it's got links to where you can buy it from. I also have just started releasing some blogs. So once a month, I'm just going to put some of my poems out there and for people to read if they're interested. So yeah, go to the website and you can grab a copy from there.
Cool. And I'll link that on the description of this episode so people can find that easily.
Wonderful.
But thank you for your vulnerability. Thank you for your willingness to turn your journal scribblings into something for others, and for just the energy that it takes sometimes to speak to this and to re-enter into some of those feelings, and then to hear other people's stories and to carry those when they give that back to you. And I think that's not insignificant. So this is a pretty amazing thing that you've done, and it's been so great to engage with it and to be able to talk to you about it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And it's been a real pleasure chatting today. So thanks.
Cool. All righty. Cheers, Julia.
See you.